A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking about the invisible division of Jerusalem. Not the walls and checkpoints, but the parallel systems that run underneath the surface. East Jerusalem has its own bus network, its own hospital system, its own schools. Critics call it apartheid. But here's the thing. Most of these systems weren't imposed. They grew out of a vacuum. And right now, the Knesset is debating a bill that could force thousands of East Jerusalemites to prove their center of life is in the city or lose residency entirely, which would effectively lock people in to whichever parallel system they're already in.
The timing on this is remarkable. That bill, it's called Amendment No. 5 to the Entry into Israel Law, and it would let the Interior Ministry revoke permanent residency for anyone who can't demonstrate that Jerusalem is the center of their life. What that means in practice is, if you spend too much time in Ramallah, if your kids go to school in the West Bank, if you get medical treatment across the Green Line, you could lose your right to live in the city you were born in. It's not theoretical. The Association for Civil Rights in Israel estimates over 14,000 people could be affected.
Because those systems depend on people moving between them.
So let's start with the legal puzzle at the center of all this. East Jerusalem's roughly 360,000 Palestinian residents hold Israeli permanent residency, not citizenship. That's according to the Jerusalem Institute for Policy Research, their 2025 figures. Permanent residency means they carry Israeli ID cards, they can travel freely within Israel, they have access to Israeli national health insurance and social security. But they can't vote in national elections. They can vote in municipal elections. Most boycott them, but the right exists.
Which creates this strange category of person. Someone who pays municipal taxes, someone who's subject to Israeli law, but someone who has no political representation in the government that makes those laws. And the municipality is supposed to serve them. But anyone who's walked through East Jerusalem neighborhoods can see what that service looks like. Roads that haven't been paved in 20 years. Sewage infrastructure that fails every winter. Garbage collection that's sporadic at best.
The data bears that out. A 2023 report from the Jerusalem Institute found that per capita municipal spending in East Jerusalem neighborhoods is about 30 to 40% of what it is in West Jerusalem. Now, the municipality would argue some of that gap is because East Jerusalem residents pay lower property taxes, which is true. The Arnona rates are lower. But that's partly because the municipality hasn't updated property assessments in East Jerusalem in decades, so the tax base is artificially suppressed, which then becomes the justification for lower spending. It's a self-perpetuating cycle.
A loop of neglect that justifies more neglect. Which brings us to the buses.
This is where it gets concrete. The Israeli bus cooperative EGD, it's the dominant public transit operator in Jerusalem. EGD stopped serving most East Jerusalem neighborhoods in the late 1990s. The official reason was security. There had been repeated stone-throwing incidents, drivers felt unsafe, and the company made a business decision to pull back.
The unofficial reason?
The unofficial reason is that the routes weren't profitable enough to justify the risk. EGD was serving those neighborhoods as a public service obligation, not because the ridership revenue covered costs. Once the security situation gave them an exit, they took it.
The buses stopped coming. What happened next?
What happened next is a classic case of self-organization filling a vacuum. Palestinian minibus cooperatives stepped in. The most prominent is the Jerusalem Ramallah Bus Cooperative, founded in 1998, which runs shared taxis and minibuses on routes that EGD demanded. Today, there are over 200 unlicensed Palestinian buses operating on about 15 routes in East Jerusalem, serving somewhere around 80,000 riders daily. Those numbers come from a 2024 report by Transport Today and Tomorrow, an Israeli transportation NGO.
These buses are illegal.
They don't have route licenses from the Municipal Transit Authority, Many don't meet Israeli insurance requirements. The drivers often don't have the commercial licenses that Israeli law requires for public transit operators. But here's the thing. Enforcement is almost non-existent. The police know the buses exist. The municipality knows. The transportation ministry knows. They're tacitly tolerated because they absorb demand that the city either cannot or will not meet. If you shut them down tomorrow, 80,000 people would have no way to get to work, to hospitals, to schools.
It's illegal infrastructure that the state depends on. That's not quite apartheid. That's a bureaucratic gray zone that works because nobody looks too closely.
And in 2022, the Transportation Ministry actually proposed formalizing this. The idea was to issue route licenses to the Palestinian cooperatives, bring them into the regulatory system, set safety standards, require insurance. The proposal died. The Palestinian drivers refused to accept the terms. Specifically, they didn't want to operate under Agad's umbrella, which was part of the deal. They saw it as legitimizing Israeli control over a system they built independently.
From Agad's perspective, they didn't want the competition. So the illegal buses keep running because everyone prefers the status quo to any alternative that requires someone to lose face or money.
There's a specific incident that captures the dynamic perfectly. In 2018, Agad tried to reintroduce a route to the Shuafat refugee camp. Bus 218. They framed it as a pilot program, one route, limited service, see how it goes. On day one, the bus was firebombed. Nobody was hurt, but Agad withdrew the route permanently. And the Palestinian minibuses kept running the same route the next day, same as they had for years. The message was clear. We don't want your buses, we have our own.
The firebombing is obviously indefensible, but the underlying logic is worth understanding. It's not just about transportation. It's about who controls the infrastructure of daily life. Every Palestinian minibus that runs on an Agad route is a small assertion of autonomy. Every passenger who chooses the Palestinian bus over an Israeli one is making a political choice, whether they think of it that way or not.
This extends to hospitals too. East Jerusalem has 6 major Palestinian-run hospitals. Makassid on the Mount of Olives, Augusta Victoria on the same ridge, St. Saint. Joseph's, the Red Crescent Maternity Hospital, the Princess Basma Rehabilitation Center, and the St. John Eye Hospital. These are significant institutions. Makassid alone has about 250 beds. They operate under Jordanian licensing, not Israeli Ministry of Health accreditation.
Wait, Jordanian licensing? How does that work? Jordan hasn't administered East Jerusalem since 1967.
It's a legacy system. Before 1967, East Jerusalem was under Jordanian rule, and the hospitals were licensed by the Jordanian Ministry of Health. After Israel annexed East Jerusalem, the hospitals never transitioned to Israeli accreditation. Partly because the Israeli system has different standards and requirements, and partly because the hospitals saw maintaining Jordanian licensing as a form of institutional resistance. So you have hospitals physically located in Israeli territory, treating patients with Israeli residency, operating under the legal framework of a foreign country. It's legally surreal.
Who pays for them?
The Palestinian Authority. Makassid's 2023 budget, and I pulled this from their annual report, was 60% funded by the PA, 25% from international donors, 15% from patient fees, 0 from Israeli sources. The Israeli National Health Insurance System, which East Jerusalem residents are entitled to use, doesn't fund these hospitals at all.
An East Jerusalemite with an Israeli health insurance card can walk into Hadassah or Shari Zedek and get treated under the Israeli system. But they can't do that at Makassid, which is in their own neighborhood.
And many choose Makassid anyway. The reasons are partly cultural. Arabic-speaking staff, family nearby, religious sensitivity around things like end-of-life care. But it's also practical. Wait times at Palestinian hospitals are often shorter for non-emergency procedures, and the PA subsidizes treatments that would require co-pays under the Israeli system. So a resident might use their Israeli insurance for an emergency. Heart attack, car accident, go straight to Hadassah, but go to Makassid for chronic care, for elective surgery, for routine checkups.
They're arbitraging the systems, using each one for what it does best.
And the PA actively encourages this. The PA pays for treatments it refers to, East Jerusalem hospitals specifically to keep those hospitals viable, it's a deliberate strategy to maintain Palestinian institutional presence in the city. If Makassid closed tomorrow, thousands of East Jerusalemites would have no choice but to use Israeli hospitals exclusively, which would be a political victory for Israel and a strategic loss for the PA.
The parallel hospital system isn't just a service gap, it's a battleground for institutional control. The PA funds hospitals in Israeli territory because having Palestinian institutions inside Jerusalem is worth more than the cost of running them.
That's the layer most outside observers miss. They see separate hospitals and think apartheid. But these hospitals exist because the PA wants them to exist, not because Israel forced Palestinians into separate facilities. Israel would be perfectly happy if every East Jerusalemite used Hadassah. That would be a form of integration, on Israeli terms.
Which brings us to schools. And if hospitals are a battleground, schools are the whole war.
This is where the long-term consequences are most stark. East Jerusalem has three parallel school systems. The Israeli public schools, which use the Hebrew curriculum, those serve about 5% of East Jerusalem Palestinian students. UNRWA schools, which use the Jordanian curriculum, about 15% of students. And then the dominant system, Palestinian Authority-affiliated private schools, which use the Palestinian curriculum, that's roughly 80% of students. Those numbers are from the Jerusalem Education Administration 2025 data.
80% of Palestinian kids in East Jerusalem are learning from textbooks that don't recognize Israel, maps that don't show the Green Line because the Green Line doesn't exist on their maps. The whole thing is Palestine. History that teaches the Nakba as the foundational event, but doesn't teach the Holocaust. Civic values framed around Palestinian national identity rather than Israeli citizenship.
They never meet an Israeli Jewish peer. Not in kindergarten, not in high school. The systems are completely sealed off from each other. A child in the Palestinian system and a child in the Israeli system could live three blocks apart and never share a classroom, a playground, a textbook, a teacher.
How did Israel respond to this? 80% of kids in its capital city learning a curriculum that effectively denies the legitimacy of the state.
They tried to change it. In 2018, the Knesset passed Amendment No. 40 to the Compulsory Education Law, what's often called the School Law. It required all schools in East Jerusalem to adopt the Israeli curriculum or lose their operating licenses. The PA responded immediately by threatening to stop paying teacher salaries in East Jerusalem if schools complied. Teachers were caught between losing their paychecks and losing their licenses.
A game of chicken with children's education as the stakes.
It lasted 2 years. In 2020, a compromise was reached. Schools could keep the Palestinian curriculum, but they had to add a civics module on Israeli law. The module covers basic things: the structure of government, the court system, citizens' rights and responsibilities. The idea was to give students at least some familiarity with the legal system they actually live under.
How's enforcement?
Some schools teach the module faithfully. Others teach it in a way that subtly undermines it, presenting Israeli law as an occupying legal framework rather than a legitimate system. And some schools simply don't teach it at all, and nobody checks. The municipality doesn't have the inspectors to monitor every classroom in East Jerusalem, and the political cost of a crackdown would be enormous.
The compromise is mostly a fiction. The Palestinian curriculum continues, the PA continues paying teachers, and a generation of East Jerusalem kids grows up learning that they live in Palestine, that Israel is an occupier, and that the municipality that provides their garbage collection is illegitimate. Meanwhile, Israeli Jewish kids in West Jerusalem learn that Jerusalem is the eternal undivided capital of the Jewish people. The two populations live in the same city but inhabit completely different cognitive worlds.
That's the most consequential part of all of this. Buses and hospitals are about daily life. Schools are about what kind of future is possible. If you have two populations that never interact as children, that learn completely different histories, that are raised with incompatible national narratives, what kind of shared civic life is possible when they become adults?
It's not a recipe for integration. It's a recipe for permanent parallel existence.
There was a profile I read. This was in Haaretz a couple of years back, about a Palestinian nurse from East Jerusalem who works at Hadassah Hospital. She's in the Israeli system every day. She speaks Hebrew fluently, she works alongside Jewish Israeli colleagues, her salary comes from the Israeli health system. but she sends her children to a PA curriculum school in her neighborhood. And she was quoted as saying, quote, I want them to know who they are.
That line hits hard. She's not rejecting Israeli society. She participates in it every day. But she's making a deliberate choice to ensure her children's identity isn't absorbed into it. And you can't really argue with that impulse. Whatever you think of the politics, every parent wants their children to know who they are.
It also means her children will never have the kind of cross-cultural fluency that she has. She can navigate both systems. Her kids will only know one. In a generation or two, that kind of bicultural competence could disappear entirely.
That's happening on both sides. How many Israeli Jewish kids in West Jerusalem speak Arabic? How many have ever had a conversation with a Palestinian peer? The separation isn't symmetrical. The power dynamics are completely different. But the mutual isolation is real.
Let's put this in comparative context, because it helps sharpen what's unique about Jerusalem. Northern Ireland has about 90% of children in segregated schools. Protestant schools and Catholic schools, according to the Northern Ireland Council for Integrated Education, their 2023 report. That's actually higher than East Jerusalem's 80%. And the consequences are similar. Separate histories, separate national narratives, separate social networks that persist into adulthood.
The mechanism is different. In Belfast, the segregation was imposed by violence during the Troubles, and then maintained by law and custom after the peace. In Jerusalem, the segregation emerged from neglect and self-organization. Israel didn't build separate schools for Palestinians. It just didn't build enough schools. So Palestinians built their own, with their own curriculum, funded by their own political leadership.
The Belfast parallel is useful for understanding the consequences, but the origin story matters for understanding the politics. In Belfast, you had two communities that both had citizenship in the same state and both had claims on the same institutions, and the state failed to integrate them. In Jerusalem, you have one community with full citizenship and one with permanent residency, and the state never really tried to integrate them in the first place. The separation was the default.
Because integration would have required Israel to treat East Jerusalemites as full citizens, with full political rights, and that would have changed the demographic balance of the city, which neither Israeli government has been willing to do. So, the neglect isn't an accident. It's a policy choice that achieves political objectives without having to explicitly articulate them.
The term political scientists use for this is strategic ambiguity. Israel claims Jerusalem is unified, but it doesn't integrate East Jerusalemites because integration would mean political empowerment. The PA claims East Jerusalem is occupied Palestinian territory, but it funds institutions inside Israeli jurisdiction because those institutions maintain Palestinian presence. Both sides benefit from the ambiguity. Both sides prefer the gray zone to any clear resolution.
The parallel systems are a feature, not a bug. They allow Israel to maintain the fiction of a unified city without the cost of actually unifying it. And they allow Palestinians to maintain national identity and institutional autonomy without having to fully accept Israeli sovereignty. Everyone gets something they want, and nobody has to make the hard choices that a real resolution would require.
The residents navigate this strategically. They're not passive victims. An East Jerusalemite might use Israeli health insurance for an emergency, take a Palestinian minibus to visit family in Ramallah, send their kids to a PA school, and pay Israeli municipal taxes while boycotting municipal elections. They're moving between systems based on what each one offers in a given context.
Active arbitrageurs of parallel infrastructure, as you put it earlier.
Which brings us back to the bill we opened with, the Center of Life Amendment. If that passes, it could force people to stop arbitraging. You'd have to prove that Jerusalem is your center of life, which means proving that you're not spending too much time in Ramallah, that your kids aren't in PA schools in the West Bank, that your medical care isn't across the Green Line. You'd have to choose.
If you choose wrong, you lose your residency, which means losing your right to live in the city you were born in, losing access to Israeli health insurance, losing freedom of movement within Israel. You'd be effectively expelled to the West Bank.
The Association for Civil Rights in Israel has warned that this could create a new category of stateless person, people born in Jerusalem with no other citizenship who lose their residency and have nowhere to go. The PA can't give them citizenship because the PA isn't a state. Jordan largely stopped granting citizenship to West Bank Palestinians decades ago. So where do they go?
That's the point. The bill is designed to push people out, to reduce the Palestinian population of Jerusalem without having to do anything as explicit as deportation. It's demographic engineering through administrative means.
If it passes, the parallel systems we've been discussing could collapse. If thousands of East Jerusalemites lose their residency, the customer base for the Palestinian minibuses shrinks. The patient base for Makassid Hospital shrinks. The student base for PA curriculum schools shrinks. The systems that emerge to fill a vacuum could be destroyed by a policy that makes the vacuum irrelevant.
Which would be a strange kind of unification, not by integrating the systems, but by eliminating the population that uses them. Jerusalem would be more unified because there would be fewer Palestinians to serve.
That's a grim way to achieve unity.
But it's consistent with the logic of the last 50 years. Israel has never wanted to integrate East Jerusalemites. The demographic math doesn't work. But it also doesn't want to formally divide the city, because Jerusalem as the eternal undivided capital is a core national commitment. So you get policies that make life difficult enough that people leave voluntarily, or that create legal mechanisms to push them out without having to call it expulsion.
The Palestinian bus network means you can get to work even if Egged won't serve your neighborhood. The Palestinian hospitals mean you can get culturally appropriate care even if the Israeli system doesn't fund it. The PA schools mean your kids can learn your national narrative even if the state doesn't recognize it. These systems are a form of resilience.
That resilience could become a vulnerability if the legal framework shifts. Because the systems exist in a gray zone, tolerated but not protected, functional but not legal. If the state decides to stop tolerating them, they have no legal defense.
Let me pull this together into three things I think are worth taking away from all this. First, the apartheid label is too blunt. These systems are real and they are separate, but they emerge from neglect and self-organization, not from a policy of segregation. Israel didn't build separate buses and hospitals for Palestinians. It just didn't build enough of anything, and Palestinians built their own. Calling it apartheid misses the mechanism and, frankly, gives critics an easy dismissal from people who know the details.
It's not that the accusation is entirely wrong. It's that it's not precise enough to be useful. If you want to understand what's actually happening, you need to look at the incentives. Israel's incentive was to avoid spending money on East Jerusalem while maintaining the fiction of unity. The PA's incentive was to build institutional presence in Jerusalem without having to accept Israeli sovereignty. Both incentives produce parallel systems, but not through the mechanism that the word apartheid implies.
Second, the parallel systems are a feature, not a bug. They work for both sides. Israel gets to claim Jerusalem is unified without paying for unification. The PA gets to maintain Palestinian institutional presence without conceding legitimacy to Israeli rule. Residents get to navigate both systems and choose what works for them. The whole arrangement is unstable and unjust in many ways, but it's stable enough that nobody has a strong incentive to change it.
The Center of Life bill is an attempt to change it unilaterally, and that's the third takeaway. The systems are fragile. They depend on PA funding, which is unpredictable. They depend on Israeli tolerance, which is eroding. A crisis in either could force a reckoning with what unified Jerusalem actually means.
Which is why I tell people, next time you hear someone say Jerusalem is a unified city, the right follow-up question is, unified for whom? Look at the bus routes. Look at the hospital referral patterns. Look at the school curricula. The infrastructure tells the real story. Paper unity and functional division can coexist for a long time, but they can't coexist forever.
The city is unified on maps and divided in every other way that matters. And the question the Center of Life bill forces is whether that ambiguity can survive or whether someone is finally going to have to choose.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In 1812, a fur trader in the Yukon named Jean-Baptiste Lecomte attempted to age cheese in a naturally occurring ice cave. But the cave's unique bacterial bloom, later identified as a psychrophilic strain of Brevibacterium, turned every wheel a vivid violet and gave it a flavor described by his journal as regret with notes of ammonia. The entire batch was buried and the cave sealed. A geological survey team rediscovered it in 1957 and reportedly fled the site.
Regret with notes of ammonia.
I have so many questions, and I want exactly none of them answered.
What happens to the center of life, Bill, is going to shape Jerusalem's future in ways that most of the coverage won't capture. It won't be about walls or borders. It'll be about whether the invisible systems that hold the city's division in place can survive a direct legal challenge. If you enjoyed this deep dive, rate the show. Tell a friend. Next week, we're looking at the weird economics of the Temple Mount status quo. This has been My Weird Bromps. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flemingtop. We'll see you next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Bromps, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.